Marvel's Horatian Ode. Did we all?
You like that, even if you don't like East 1960?
Oh, I don't mean that.
I don't want to spend a lot of time on that comparison today. I gave it to you to do yourself over the weekend, and I hope you will have not thought that I was wool gathering in supposing that there was something in common between these two poems. Oh, two of these, I would like to say, though. I propose that these were the two, I said the two greatest, two of the greatest, anyway, perhaps the two greatest political poems in the language. And that term, political poem, is one which, as it were, I meant to be provocative. Plainly, they are political in an obvious sense, that they, each of them deals with a quite specific political event or cluster of events. I would go further, though, to say, paradoxically, if you like, that what makes them the greatest political poems in the language is that they, in fact, transcend politics, in the sense that they transcend the particular side that the poet is on. As one saw, I hope, with Easter 1916 last week, Yeats's sympathies, of course, were divided, but they were predominantly, naturally, with the Irish, who rose in 1916 and who were shot for it. But this is not the substance of the poem. The poem is as far as possible from being a propagandist poem. The poem is as far as possible from saying all the right was on the Irish patriot side. That is not what the poem is ultimately about. The poem is about what is involved in taking resolute and effective political action in an extreme situation, whatever side you're on. It is, therefore, it transcends the particular political event out of which it arises, in that it is talking about the nature of effective political action, the nature of the really committed, if necessary, fanatical political agent, whether in that case he was British or Irish, for instance. And I hope you'll have seen that this is the extraordinarily striking thing about Marvell's poem about Cromwell. Marvell was a parliamentarian, a Cromwellian. He was the assistant to Milton when Milton was Latin secretary to the Commonwealth. It's true that Marvell was always a less extreme and fanatical person than Milton was, so that, for instance, Marvell was able to survive as a member of Parliament when the King came back in 1660, whereas Milton found himself forced into private life and indeed in some danger. Nonetheless, Marvell was a Republican, a parliamentarian, and yet this is the poem in which the King, who the enemy of the Parliament, in fact, gets the most splendid tribute of anywhere in English poetry. He nothing common did nor mean upon that memorable scene. In fact, it's worth looking at those lines a little more. That Charles, he wove a net, this is Cromwell, line 15, he wove a net of such a scope that Charles himself might chase to Carisbrook's narrow case, the castle of Carisbrook in the Isle of Wight, where Charles was finally captured, that thence the royal actor born the tragic scaffold might adorn, while round the armed bands did clap their bloody hands. He nothing common did or mean upon that memorable scene, but with his keener eye the axe's edge did try, nor called the gods with vulgar spite to vindicate his helpless right, but bowed his comely head down as upon the bed. Several things interesting there. First is at the end of his life, according to this parliamentarian Cromwellian poet, the doomed king as he went to be beheaded, in fact, by the nobility and dignity of his bearing, as it were, was, in a sense, morally, rose morally superior to all his enemies. Also, you will see, most notably, that the imagery here is indeed of the stage of the theatre. As I suggested to you, it was distinctly in Easter 1916 too, where the whole thing is seen in terms of a performance of actors upon a stage. A comedy, a tragedy. That is almost the governing concern, at any rate, through the first half of Yeats's poem. So here, that thence the royal actor born the tragic scaffold might adorn, he nothing commented or mean upon that memorable scene. Royal actor. Well, and one says this means royal agent merely, the person who is acting, the king, and in action. But inevitably, for Marvell's first readers as for us, it has more notably the secondary meaning of the professional actor, the man who acts a part. Similarly, upon that memorable scene, which goes right back to the Latin word scaena, scaena, according to how you pronounce it, which is the stage. And similarly, even the tragic scaffold is a pun on theatre. It is the scaffold which he had to mount in order to be beheaded in full view of the vengeful crowd. But the scaffold was also the word for the outdoor stage, which was run up for an out-of-doors performance. This too is then, the two poems have most strikingly in common. First, an extraordinary impartiality rising above the particular issue. Secondly, the way in which the thing is seen principally in a theatrical metaphor. And one last point, which I hope you realize, pointed out last time that the most difficult and profound and penetrating thing that Yeats is saying in Easter 1916, he says not explicitly, but entirely in terms of an image. An image, sustained image of the stone in the middle of the stream, and then the other things, the clouds that move and are reflected in the stream, the wildfowl that splash upon it, and so on. It's not specifically said these people were fanatics and therefore had cut themselves off from human affection. That is said by implication and all the more permanently and pungently because it is insinuated without our realizing it. That is what we get from that sustained image. And the same is surely true of Marvell's treatment of Cromwell. So restless Cromwell could not cease in the inglorious arts of peace, but through adventurous war urged his active star, and like the three-forked lightning first, breaking the clouds where it was nursed, did through his own side his fiery way divide. Then burning through the air he went, and palaces and temples rent, and Caesar's head at last did through his laurels blast. 'Tis madness to resist or blame the force of angry heaven's flame. And if he would speak too much to the man is due, who from his private gardens where he lived reserved and austere, etc. But the crucial point about Cromwell, which is made without ever breaking the surface of quite genuine veneration for the man of destiny and the man of force, is in those comparisons, that imagery in which he is compared to an active star, to the three-foot lightning breaking the clouds, with something that goes burning through the air and rends palaces and temples, and which in fact gets through to Caesar and blasts his laurels, to angry heaven's flame. In other words, Cromwell is continually associated with the forces of the heavens, with meteors, comets, thunderbolts, the lightning. forces of nature, which in fact are seen rather more in their destructive aspect than in their creative. But again, it is not said anywhere. It would have been very difficult for Marvell to say. Cromwell, like all men of destiny of this sort, is in fact doing more harm than good, or as much harm as good. He doesn't have to say that because he has insinuated it again. Again, without our realizing it, if we just respond to the images with our imagination, without ever needing to paraphrase, it is working upon us. Again, it seems to me the two poems are very much alike in that respect too. And to proceed, it is not for nothing that the poem that we should think of in relation to these poems that Yeats is now writing in 1915 should be a 17th century poem, the poem of Andrew Marvell. I made this point several sessions ago before we plunged into a vision of the system. And it's the most important point which I now want to return to. Yeats, in the second decade of this century, from about 1910 onwards, was discovering for himself the riches of particularly English poetry of the 17th century. We see him beginning to do this, you remember, when he explicitly cites, as well as imitates, Ben Jonson at the beginning of the 1912 volume Responsibility. We have seen him naming Donne, also John Donne, as one of those that he now wants to emulate. Let him sit down when his journey is done with Landor and with Donne. The poem which I certainly hope you have read and pondered very carefully for yourself, because I don't think we are going to have time to talk about it in class, unless you force me to. The poem which I have drawn to your attention more than once. The second poem in the selection that you're getting from the Wild Swans, a poem in memory of Major Robert Gregory, pages 52 through to 55, is in fact, the stanza structure is planned very elaborately upon an ode stanza of an ode by Abraham Cowley, another 17th century English poet. I pointed out that, several things about this, just to remind you. First, that this was in effect forced upon Yeats by his the change in his political allegiance, the hardening of his political prejudices against mass democracy. Hence, he becomes interested in a deliberately aristocratic, non-democratic society and the place of the poet and of the artist generally in such a society. And of course, England, Italy of the 15th and 16th centuries, England of the 16th and 17th were such societies. It's not for nothing that he identifies himself with Ben Jonson, who maintained himself, as did virtually all poets in those centuries, by finding a noble and wealthy patron who recognized his worth and who supported him financially. This is now what the Yeats is now living out, the fantasy that this can be his relation to his aristocrat, Lady Gregory, just as Ben Jonson's was to his. Major Robert Gregory, as you will see, therefore, is continually identified in a sort of refrain with Philip Sidney, the man who was the all-round courtier, who was himself both patron and poet. Thus, Yeats's political development and his stylistic development go absolutely hand in glove. It's a most impressive example of the way the man hangs absolutely together. His politics does not pull him one way and his poetics the other. As his political and social situation changes, so his style changes to correspond to it. I pointed out that this change involved, in fact, Yeats abandoning all, or nearly all, the 19th century models that he had used through the first 20 or more years of his writing life, and switching his allegiance to these much older poets, 16th and 17th century poets, and retaining from the 19th as active influences upon his writing only a thoroughly unrepresentative Victorian like Walter Savage Landor. Another thing I pointed out, which I now repeat, is that Yeats, in doing this, was rediscovering the riches of a part of the English literary tradition which at the same period was being rediscovered by Yeats' much younger contemporary T.S. Eliot. In both cases, both Yeats and Eliot, a crucial influence upon them was the great edition of John Donne, the first scholarly edition ever by H.J.C. Grierson in 1912. Yeats' discovery of this, his highly technical interest in it, it can be discovered from letters that he wrote to Grierson, which you can find in the big letters of Yeats, and it's by Alan Wade. Look up Grierson in the index. This, I think, is remarkable from two points of view. First, it is astonishing, I think, when you think about it, that Yeats found himself into this common area with Eliot, coming at it, as we have seen, from such a very bizarre and special direction. Parochially Irish, and with all this occult, mystagogic interests of his, and you would suppose that this would make him eccentric. In fact, it does not. In fact, despite all that, he worked his way towards rediscovering the 17th century at just the same time when Eliot was doing so and was propagandizing for it in his critical essays, with a propaganda that has never, in fact, ceased to work upon us. We still esteem the 17th century, we should esteem the 17th century poets of wit, like John, Johnson, and Marvell, much, much more than they were esteemed at any time since their own day. Well, it's a big rediscovery. And I think, again, it is extraordinarily to Yeats's credit. This is a poet who is never too old to learn. Remember that by the time he's now over 50, he has for 15 years, really, been generally esteemed throughout the English-speaking world as the most accomplished, the greatest living poet since the death of Swinburne. Not altogether fairly, because Thomas Hardy was still alive, but still people in general didn't remember that. And he is not, nonetheless, he does not stand upon his dignity. He is not too proud to switch his reading, to learn, to permit a much younger man whom he might have regarded as a dangerous rival, someone like Ezra Pound, to actually teach him things. Yeats, remember, never had a formal or systematic education when he was young. And this shows, I suggested, in a sort of undisciplined thinking that goes on, and which, for my money, is at its worst in A Vision. Nonetheless, he also has the virtue of that condition. He never stops educating himself. He is always prepared to give himself a new course of reading, as apparently he did during this period. I want to take a further example of this. One could take almost any of these poems. A particularly clear example of it is a poem that I have spoken of already. The last poem that you are given from Michael Rabatis and the Dancer, which is the second of the collections we've been looking at lately. And this is the poem, A Prayer for My Daughter. This follows, we'll take with it, the poem which we have already looked at, The Second Coming, on page 91. I'll read the second coming, comment upon that, and then go into a prayer for my daughter and comment upon that. The second coming we have read already. You should be prepared for it. It's interesting in that it is related quite immediately to the vision, to the last chapter of the vision, or the last two chapters, really, where he's particularly concerned with the way in which the 28 phases of the moon system can be seen to work out through recorded history, where he is particularly interested in recovering from ancient thinking the notion of the great year, Magnus Annus, a year which includes thousands upon thousands of our normal years, a lunar year. He explains all this. Again, he explains this fairly clearly, and it's fairly interesting, and it is immediately relevant to the Second Coming, but is not absolutely necessary to it. Thus, the Second Coming is an example of a poem which does rest very heavily upon the visionary system, which is, for most people, enriched if you read it in conjunction with that appropriate section, but which is not absolutely dependent upon it. You remember Mrs. Cuff asked this question some time ago, how do the poems relate to the system? And I had to answer, well, they relate in different ways. Some of them I have suggested. One of them was the double vision of Michael Robartes, which we looked at last week, do indeed depend upon the system in a way which is damaging to the poem. It is really a cryptic text which you are supposed to be a sort of theological exegete of. And this shows up in, I suggested, a certain stridency and even carelessness of style in a poem like that. Here, however, I think we have a different case. This poem, The Second Coming, and I put this out too, is in fact very closely related to that unsatisfactory poem, The Double Vision of Michael Robartes, which is belongs to a couple of years earlier. The Sphinx, you remember, appears there in this curious hallucinatory vision on the rock of Kashel of the Sphinx and the dancer, and another heraldic figure. And quite plainly, that Sphinx is here in The Second Coming also. Turning and turning in the widening gyre, the falcon cannot hear the falconer. Things fall apart, the centre cannot hold, mere anarchy is loosed upon the world, the blood-dimmed tide is loosed, and everywhere the ceremony of innocence is drowned. The best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity. Surely some revelation is at hand, surely the second coming is at hand. The second coming. Hardly are those words out, when a vast image of Spiritus Mundi troubles my sight. Somewhere in stands of the desert, a shape with lion body and the head of a man, a gaze blank and pitiless as the sun, is moving its slow thighs, while all about it reel shadows of the indignant desert birds. The darkness drops again, but now I know that 20 centuries of stony sleep were vexed to nightmare by a rocking cradle, and what rough beast its hour come round at last slouches towards Bethlehem to be born. That should read hardly those words out when a vast image out of Spiritus Mundi. When a vast image out of Spiritus Mundi, your text. Perhaps is it people writing your text?
Yes.
You've got to go. Oh, the out has been missed. I've got another edition of this text. Well, we've talked about this. It is a very blasphemous poem. It uses a traditional Christian notion of the second coming of the Redeemer. But it puts it in this enormous perspective in which the coming of Christ is only one coming out of many. There have been other eruptions of the divine into the human under other auspices, Gates believes. In particular, he appears to believe that if you could work out the enormous lunar years, you would find that a lunar year, which in some parts of the vision comprises as much as 26,000 of our solar years, a lunar year is the year of, as it were, one God, one God's rule. Certainly, this is a poem which sees the end of Christendom, 20 centuries, and he sees Christendom coming to an end. He's sure it is coming to an end because he can see mass democracy destroying everything that Christendom has most valuably created. And so the second coming that he looks forward to is not the second coming of the Christian God, of Christ, but of some other God, of which the poet can say nothing at this point except that it will seem as much bestial as divine. Indeed, this is a striking psychological truth in this poem, I think. As human beings, knowing only the human and temporal dimension, if we can agree that from time to time our human life is erupted into, broken into by living forces from outside the human, all we should be able to say is that the thing that has happened is a non-human thing. And whether it is superhuman or subhuman, we should not be able to say. All we know is it's other than human. And hence it is true, I think, that the eruption of the divine into the human, the eruption of the eternal into the temporal, will always seem subhuman, bestial, obscene. We've seen Yeats talk about this already in The Magi, the uncontrollable mystery on the bestial floor, what he speaks of as the birth of a god to a human being, the birth at Bethlehem, and hence the birth of whatever else we may now be looking forward to, the new Annunciation. Hence what rough beast, it's our command at last, slouches toward Bethlehem to be born, and really, as it were, the whole poem, it's incredibly powerful, comes together and explodes in the forcing together the calculated collision of those two words, slouch and Bethlehem. Slouch, a word which carries even in its sound and in all its connotations the notion of what is ungainly, only half-shaped, misshapen, bestial, subhuman, and Bethlehem, which necessarily is the emblem of all that is, on the contrary, refined, virtuous, innocent and redeeming. The two words, the whole poem really works up to the point at which these two words can be brought together and of course with enormous tension between them as they jump apart, come together and jump apart. I think it's the expression, the sense that we have. In a short while, we shall come upon a poem. Some of you will have discovered it already, reading ahead, and indeed some of you will know it from anthologies, I should think. Again, another of Yeats's most famous poems, one of the very few sonnets that he wrote, Leda and the Swan, which in fact you get on page 114, 115, don't turn to it now, which is plainly a treatment from a different angle of the same issue. In the archaic Greek myth, Leda is one of the several human women who is ravished and impregnated by the god, Zeus, in the form of a beast. You remember there is a whole slew of myths of that sort. Zeus rapes Europa in the form of a bull. He rapes Danae in the form of a golden shower. He rapes Leda in the form of a swan. And this sonnet in fact, presents just that. The act of ravishment of the male swan descends upon the quailing human woman. A subject which is obscene and shocking in itself. And Yeats's treatment does not in the least evade any of the obscene shock. On the contrary, the sheer physicality of the encounter is insisted upon, for all that it is done in a poetic form so extremely formal and conventional as the sonnet. It is a remarkable poem, as you will see when you look at it. But in Yeats's view of the matter, this myth and other Greek myths of this sort do represent, as it were, folk memories of an earlier annunciation, the annunciation before the Christian one. After all, the Christian belief in the virgin birth does represent precisely the same sexual conjunction between a human woman, Mary, and a God, the Holy Spirit, we are told. In the same way, these myths of Zeus impregnating a human woman through, in the form of a swan or a bull, appears, therefore, to be an anticipation of the central Christian myth. And Yeats takes it seriously, and he treats our leader and the swan as the divine virgin birth of a previous religious dispensation, a non-Christian one. And hence, we have already, you see, a three-tier system way back in, let's say, 20 centuries before Christ or more. We have the virgin birth, the human and divine conjunction represented by Leda and the swan and many other images, many other myths of the same sort. Then, in the first years of our era, we do have Bethlehem and the virgin birth of the God. Now, about the year 2000, we have what is now spoken of with sardonic and threatening irony as the second coming. The new annunciation, the new Bethlehem, the new rough beast that is slouching to be born, of which we can say nothing except that it will be shocking to us, and it will represent the end of our era, the end of the Christian era, and the beginning of a new arc. The second coming. And in Yeats's fully developed historical theories, these may by no means be the whole story. Conceivably, there was an earlier annunciation before this one, and an earlier still, and maybe another, and another. It is in this way, and on this enormous scale, that Yeats's view of history is cyclical. Yeah.
If that's all that's true, why does he use the word second in the title? Why is he referred to as the second coming? Is he playing on our belief that there's only been one coming so far?
I think so. He, as it were, the title prepares us, if we have any Christian training or knowledge at all, for a poem of Christian devotion, or might if we didn't know the sort of poem we were dealing with. And so we have expectations created by the title, which gradually and finally, abruptly and violently, are reversed. Yes, and in that sense it is ironical. It is a trap. A sardonic trap. The second coming. You think there's been one and there's going to be another? There have been many. And also this coming will not be, the thing that comes will not be the sort of thing which Christian training would lead to. This cyclical view of history, you remember, we came across it once when we were, quite a long time ago now, when we were looking at that late play, the introduction to the Words Upon the Window Pane, in association with the late 17th century Italian thinker Vico, and the Viconian cycle. Vico's cyclical interpretation of history, which at this very same moment, it's interesting to note, was influencing that other great Irish writer of our time, James Joyce. Vico has an important structural role to play in the Finnegan Wake. And now there's one phrase in here, the second coming, in the second coming, which, well, before we go on to that, there are many phrases here. This is the most exploratory poem in that phrases are from this poem have been taken out and quoted by people who don't believe in this particular system at all. I mean, the best lack all conviction while the worst are full of passionate intensity. Or things fall apart the centre cannot hold. One finds these phrases, once we've read them, coming to mind in all sorts of situations, just as you find them, in fact, quoted in leaders in newspapers. Even quoted by people who don't know what it is they're quoting. And that is to say, I think this is most interesting example of the way in which this poem, which is so, when you look at it, it's so closely tied into this idiosyncratically special and eccentric system, in fact, soars completely free of that. I mean, lots of people have felt that, you know, when you're really depressed about the way the world is, things fall apart, the centre cannot hold. Or, even more striking, really, as a judgment upon what really goes wrong in our democratic societies. The best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity. I think it's perfectly legitimate to take those two lines out from this particular system of this poem and to ask if they are not profoundly true of public and political action in any case. The best lack all conviction because to a liberal mind, it is precisely the best who can always see the other side of the question. And hence they are continually at disadvantage with the violent, the stupid, the fanatical, who, because they cannot or will not allow themselves ever to have the imagination to look at the same issue from somebody else's point of view, therefore are single-minded, therefore have passionate intensity. One sees it time and time again in the political scene. The best men and women, because they are the best, are thereby hamstrung and crippled in action. They will always hesitate. Whereas the worst, the single-minded and ruthless fanatic, is full of passionate intensity. In that sense, it is to me that it's sort of a profoundly wise thing to say in a profoundly memorable fashion, quite independent of whether you choose to believe in this system at all. Another phrase here is, almost any phrase is important, but the one that I now want to look at because it is what takes us on to the next point is that line, "The ceremony of innocence is drowned." Those words, ceremony and innocence, you will have noticed, I hope, are echoed most notably in the long poem that follows A Prayer for My Daughter, which in every other way is almost is very, very different from the second coming. Yeats deliberately put these poems together, the second coming and then A Prayer for My Daughter. Very different poems. He meant the contrast between them, but there is this highly significant link, ceremony and innocence. I hope I've got time to read this. prayer for my daughter. Once more the storm is howling, and half hid under this cradle hood and coverlid, my child sleeps on. There is no obstacle but Gregory's Wood and one bare hill, whereby the haystack and roof-levelling wind, bred on the Atlantic, can be stayed. And for an hour I have walked and prayed because of the great gloom that is in my mind. I have worked and prayed for this young child an hour, and heard the sea wind scream upon the tower and under the arches of the bridge, and scream in the elms above the flooded stream, imagining in excited reverie that the future years had come, dancing to a frenzied drum under the murderous innocence of the sea. May she be granted beauty, and yet not beauty to make a stranger's eye distraught, or hers before a look at glass. For such, being made beautiful overmuch, consider beauty a sufficient end, lose natural kindness, and maybe the heart-revealing intimacy that chooses right, and never find a friend. Helen, being chosen, found life flat and dull, and later had much trouble from a fool. While that great queen that rose out of the spray, being fatherless, could have her way, yet chose a bandy-legged smith for man. It's certain that fine women eat a crazy salad with their meat, whereby the horn of plenty is undone. In courtesy I'd have her chiefly learned. Hearts are not had as a gift, but hearts are earned by those that are not entirely beautiful. Yet many that have played the fool for beauty's very self has charm made wise, and many a poor man that has roved, loved, and thought himself beloved from a glad kindness cannot take his eyes. May she become a flourishing hidden tree, all her thoughts may like the linnet be, and have no business but dispensing round their magnanimities of sound, nor but in merriment begin a chase, nor but in merriment a quarrel. Oh, may she live like some green laurel rooted in one dear perpetual place. My mind, because the minds that I have loved, the sort of beauty that I have approved, prosper but little, has dried up of late, yet knows that to be choked with hate may well be of all evil chances chief. If there's no hatred in the mind, assault and battery of the wind can never tear the linnet from the leaf. An intellectual hatred is the worst. So let her think opinions are accursed. Have I not seen the loveliest woman born out of the mouth of plenty's horn, because of her opinionated mind, barter that horn and every good by quiet natures understood, for an old bellows full of angry wind. Considering that all hatred is driven hence, the soul recovers radical innocence, and learns at last that it is self-delighting, self-appeasing, self-affrighting, and that its own sweet will is heaven's will. She can, though every face should scowl, and every windy quarter howl, or every bellows burst, be happy still. And may her bridegroom bring her to a house where all's accustomed, ceremonious. For arrogance and hatred are the wares peddled in the thoroughfares. How but in custom and in ceremony are innocence and beauty born? Ceremonies are named for the rich horn, and custom for the spreading laurel tree. Innocence, you see, is the poem, is what this poem is very much about. The murderous innocence of the sea, the end of the second stanza. The soul recovers radical innocence, last line on bottom of page 93, and at the end, how but in custom and in ceremony are innocence and beauty born. It was inevitable that he would write this poem. After all, here he is saying the new and hideous annunciation is going to come about the year 2000, well, and he's just had a child who might survive the year 2000. Naturally, he would be inhuman if he did not say, yes, but what in fact is this child of mine going to live to see? And how is she to survive in a future which he has just said in the second coming is brutal at best and maybe desolate and violent? Well, he answers, the ceremony of innocence is drowned. In general terms, but may she, and he then sketches a way in which this girl child just born to him may, with luck, still find some of the innocence which in general is being driven out of the world. She does so by getting by, well, in two ways. First, he doesn't want her to be a raving beauty, because he's seen that this is too heavy a burden, a sort of fatal burden for women, particularly for Maud Gonne, who is, of course, the woman in The Loveliest Woman Born Out of the Mouth of Plenty's Horn. He wants her to be attractive enough to attract a man, but not attractive enough to turn men's heads. More particularly, though, he wants her to be taken by a man who lives according to custom and ceremony and convention and usage. Now, this is a very great challenge to our normal thoughts. We normally suppose that spontaneity and innocence are here, and that convention and custom are the enemies of innocence and spontaneity. Yeats is concerned in this poem to say that the very opposite is true, that insofar as innocence, spontaneity can survive, it can survive only in those uncharacteristic places in the 20th century where unwritten custom and ceremony